The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Douglas North, MHK, David Ashford is on Man in Line today. If you want to get in touch and talk to David, call 66 13 68, text or WhatsApp on 166 177, or you can email studio at manxradio.com. Well, member of the House of Keys for 10 years, it was the 2016 general election, which he got in on, and of course previously Minister at the Department of Health and Social Care and Treasury, and currently the Minister for the Cabinet Office. David Ashford is on Man in Line today. Well, Faster Mai, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Andy.
The Cabinet Office is, you ran through this last time, it covers everything and kind of housekeeps for a lot of people, doesn't it?
Yeah, it's the centre of government. It's the beating heart of government, where it holds all the centralised services like government technology services, Crown External Relations, the Office of Human Resources, the executive function for council and ministers, and other functions I will have forgotten to mention there as well. I do joke sometimes that Cabinet Office is the place where government places things that nobody else wants to or knows where to put, but we really do have the central services and where the machine that helps drive the rest of government and support the functions across the rest of government.
Obviously, Crown and External Relations involves anti-money laundering, combating the finance of terror, is that right?
So there's also obviously a lot of that based within the Department of Home Affairs as well. So Crown and External Relations does actually offer support in that area. Most of the anti-money laundering team that used to sit within Cabinet Office has now transferred over to the Department of Home Affairs, so it's, which is a much more sensible place for it to sit.
Right, do you get any sense...
Including the MoneyVal scheme.
I was going to mention that. Do you get any sense of where we are with MoneyVal?
So in terms of MoneyVal, obviously it's a fixed process that you go through. MoneyVal itself actually drives a lot of that process and the timescales involved. We need to make sure that we're ready, that we're compliant, and we're ready to put the best face of the Isle of Man forward.
Okay, you've obviously, I mentioned you were at the DHSC for a while. Have you got any reaction to the announcement about the hospice?
Yeah, so the very first thing to say, obviously, is the services that hospice provide our community are absolutely essential services. We never know what the future holds for either ourselves or our loved ones, or when tragically we may need to call on the services that are offered for hospice. When I was Minister for Health and Social Care, one of the final acts I did as Minister before I finished that role after the 2021 election was work out a new funding settlement for hospice, which saw their funding rise from the just under 600,000 they were getting in 2021 under the new model to the just under 1.8 million that they're getting today. The important thing, I think, is in light of the announcement yesterday that DHSC and Manx Care work with the hospice to understand what the cost pressures are that they're facing and what can be done to actually secure the model that we have and that we, you know, is absolutely essential to our island. I know that DHSC has already started speaking to hospice and so has Manx Care to understand that, and hospice themselves said in their release last night that they were working with both parties to see what could be done.
Yeah, I've got an email in from Jane. Thank you, Jane, who just said, you know, could you ask David about this? Critical service and shouldn't have to rely on charity. Obviously, a lot is raised via charitable donations. Is there any possibility it will be brought in to Manx Care or DHSC?
Personally, I wouldn't want to see that. I think one of hospice's great strengths is the fact that it's a third sector organisation. It's proved over the years to be very adaptable. I've had the great honour and pleasure to work with three different CEOs of hospice and two different chair people. Sir Miles Walker, who was the chair through most of my political career, and Chris Hall, who's the chair of hospice now, two very good chair people. And I think one of the great advantages that the hospice has is it is very adaptable. It's very close to the community. It's very embedded in the community. And I worry if it became a pure government service, you'd lose something. Yeah. So I think it being a third sector organisation is right. That is the model across the water in the British Isles as well, also in the Channel Islands. But what's important is that we actually support them in the delivery of those services, because without doubt, in my mind and my experience of 4.5 years as Minister for Health and Social Care, what hospice does is not just critical, but they also do it in a way that ultimately saves the rest of the system money.
How close is it to the edge, do you know?
So from what I can see, and obviously I've only seen the announcement the same as anyone else last night, I've not been privy to any more information than what people have seen. I had a quick look last night at hospice's accounts and the things that hospice has said. And what seems to have fundamentally changed is actually the charitable giving side. As I say, hospice in terms of taxpayer funding has basically seen a close on 300% increase in taxpayer funding over the last 5 years, going from the just under 600,000 that they got in 2021 to the just under 1.8 million a year that they're getting now. So there has been a fundamental change in the taxpayer, but on the other side, it appears they're not getting the same number of legacies coming through that they used to get. They used to have a lot of money left to them by people in their wills, and charitable giving seems to be down as well. So from what I can see, and like I say, I've got no more information than the member of the general public, that's where the pressure seems to be coming.
Okay, just to reiterate again, just forgive me, would you... Why do you think it's best served in the third sector?
So I think it's best served in the third sector because it makes them more adaptable. I think the hospice has proved itself to actually be able to adapt to changing times, to expand services in a different way. And I think actually using the third sector, they can deliver the services cheaper than government can in central. Government and Manx Care and the general health service is a very wide-ranging beast. I know that from being, like I say, DHSC minister for 4.5 years. And I think hospice is a very special element, and I think the right place for it to be delivered is in the third sector. I think hospice has shown that over many, many years with the absolutely amazing support it's been able to deliver to our community, that shows the model works. What we need to do is work on the nuancing of the financing.
Okay, let's get to the lines now, shall we? And we've got Julian with us first. Hi, Julian. You're live with David Ashford, MHK.
Hi, Andy. Hi, David.
Hi, Julian.
You were saying about hospice funding. From what I see, hospice needs about £5.8 million a year for all of it, but government's funding it to about a third of that. I noticed, though, that Manx Care's increase in spending 1 year's worth would fund the hospice for about 5 to 6 years fully. And I noticed that Chris Thomas mentioned in Timwood recently that they need to get the reins on Manx Care's overspending. Is there any talk about, instead of sort of mincing about and trying to sort of bring things into the hospital and stuff, why not just get a control on Manx Care's overspending and make sure that palliative care and everything is fully funded? Because the trajectory is going that assisted dying is going to be the default, not a choice, isn't it?
Well, I don't agree with that last comment, first of all, Julian. I don't think assisted dying is going to become the default. Assisted dying is there for very specific reasons, and the bill that's come through only allows it in very specific reasons as well, where someone has had a terminal diagnosis. So it's not open season, so to speak, for people in that regard. In terms of hospice itself, like I say, I was the Minister for Health and Social Care in 2021 when the review into hospice funding came forward, when we looked to try and get a model. The model when I first became Minister in Health was simply a grant. Hospice used to receive a set grant, and that grant hadn't gone up for many years. It was, I think, £592,000 a year. What we changed the system to was actually commissioning of services. So Manx Care, DHSC, as was, commissioned physical services of hospice hospice and provide funding for those specific services. I believe the overall running costs from hospice, from what the new CEO, who I haven't had a chance to meet yet, personally, has said, is it's about 7 million, not 5 million, 7 million. So the amount that's being provided covers roughly around about 25% of the funding. But it is important to emphasise as well that it's not a like-for-like comparison. I've seen on social media last night a lot of people comparing it to other jurisdictions and percentages. In terms of our health service, we actually provide what's termed benefits in kind to the hospice as well. So, for instance, in addition to the 1.76 million that they're getting per annum, we also cover a range of incidental costs, including the supply of drugs and dressings, laundry services, clinical and sterile supplies, x-ray and pathology services, ambulance support, IT, estates and engineering services, and also crucially professional indemnity, that a lot of hospices in other jurisdictions actually don't get that support. It's actually rolled up into their grant and they have to pay for it out of that grant, all the charitable amounts that they actually raise.
Julian?
Well, I mean, we've got an ageing population, as Paul Crane has mentioned. And if you're right at 7 million, well, wasn't the overspend with Manx Care 30 million last year? So that would pay for four and a bit years of the hospice. I mean, all this siloing of money, surely how somebody is at the end of life has to be a priority. I mean, if you're only paying a third of it now, it's clearly not a priority, is it?
Well, it is. I think it is a priority. And the very fact that their funding has increased, like I say, from the taxpayer, from the just under 600,000 5 years ago to just under 1.8 million now, shows that it is a priority. Because, as I say, the services hospice provide are essential. In terms of Manx Care overspends, I've been very clear on this myself. I've been clear in Timbald over the last few years. We do need to get to grips with the cost of the health service. We need to be honest to people what things cost. And as we do have an ageing population, as you say, things do come under more strain. And that's why it is absolutely essential that we start moving away from a hospital-led model and into a community delivery model. I know Manx Care has started that process. Is it going fast enough? That's up for debate. And that's what Chris Thomas was referring to as well. Myself and Chris both worked together on a motion, with his original motion, my amended motion that went through Tim Ward a couple of years ago, which started a lot of the governance review that's going on now within DHSC and Manx Care, actually saying what we need to do is focus on the model and look at the best, most efficient way that we can deliver care to people, and fundamentally try and as much as possible prevent people from getting ill and getting to the stage of needing hospital admission, which is extremely costly in the first place.
Okay, final word, Julian.
Yeah, I know. Going into the community, though, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it must be a lot more expensive and logistically difficult to have people at home having the same level of care as in a proper facility where you've got 24/7 nurses and doctors available all the time with medication and all the rest of it. I know it's a difficult issue, but I just think that the focus needs to be on, I mean, you know, what was it, 380 odd million last year for Manx Care, and this year's 412. I mean, is it going to be 440 million next year, in which case is hospice again going to fall into that black hole?
Okay. And that's the concern. The one thing I need to be absolutely clear on is the monies that have gone to hospice have not been impacted, as far as I'm aware, by anything to do with the Manx Care overspend. That's a completely separate issue. But you are absolutely right. Where is the trajectory of travel? And if you actually look at the elevator that Manx Care's expenditure and the trajectory's been on, that's very frightening if you fast forward it 10 years and look where it'll be then and the portion of government expenditure that would then equal. And that's why we do need to do some of the changes around community. In terms of community versus hospital models, the examples from around the world where countries have managed to do the shift to community actually shows that the community models, believe it or not, are actually generally cheaper. Hospital care is very expensive to provide, and the providing it in the community and doing that preventative piece is very important. So we need to be working with the GP surgeries, with the pharmacists in the community, with the nurses in the community, to ensure that we can try and limit people getting to the illness stage where they need to be admitted to hospital in the first place, because an admission to hospital generally means someone is quite seriously unwell.
Okay, all right, Julian, we appreciate that. Thanks for calling today. Just to go back to the costs, for Manx Care. I mean, have medical costs, healthcare costs, gone up exponentially? Is it a recent thing? Is it since COVID? Or why do they seem to be racing ahead?
So healthcare inflation has always tended to trend above regular inflation. If you plot the two out on a graph going back over the last 20 years, healthcare expenditure has always generally trended higher. As new drugs come onto the market, they tend to be quite expensive, but they are the best treatments available. As drugs become older in fashion, so to speak, they tend to become cheaper. But the point is that we now manage conditions in a very different way to the way we did, say, 10 years ago, the way we did 20 years ago. And these new management tools all cost money. So there has been a lot of pressure put on. And as I say, as there's an ageing population as well, when your population is ageing, you tend to find people with increased morbidities coming forward and presenting. But what we need to do, like I say, is get down to the fundamental shift that we need to do of getting people into the community, getting the support there for them to prevent them becoming ill in the first place, or putting it off as long as possible and keeping people as independent as long as possible.
Okay. And where does that stand with members of the family being recompensed as carers?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, because it's something I've always been passionate about in politics. Carers allowance, for instance, was something that hadn't been adjusted for many, many years prior to the year I was Treasury Minister. And one of the things I was absolutely determined to do in my first budget was start a direction of travel of increasing the amount of carers allowance. I campaigned for that. I got it into my budget for the year I was Treasury Minister. And it is something I think we need to look at, because all the carers that are out there in our community are doing an absolutely invaluable job. They are doing a job that, if those people ended up into the health service, we talk about the trajectory of costs now, the trajectory of cost would be an awful lot higher if those people weren't doing the amazing caring job that they are for their relatives.
They're an unseen army, aren't they?
They are, and you know, and also they put their own lives on hold. I've got constituents who I know care for children who are ill. Their children are not in the best of health for various reasons, and literally, you know, they have no lives of their own. Their entire dedication is around their parents, their aunties, their uncles, their brothers, their sisters, their children. And they don't always generally have a lot of support network either. So anything that we can do to help support carers, I'm a very, firm believer in. I've met and spoken with Crossroads, Isle of Man, who do a fabulous job in helping to try and support carers as well out in our community. And we do, from my point of view as a politician, need to do more in the space of supporting carers.
And the carers we also don't hear about are the children and young people who care for adults, who
race
home from school to look after a parent.
And it's not just when they get home from school either, it's before they go to school. I've spoken to young carers over the years that I've been an MHK and a Douglas councillor for many years before that, where, they're up early in the morning. They're getting their parent to, or their, the other person they're caring for, to a position where they can see the day out so that young person can be at school. They then race home from school. They do the care for them through to the night. And any support we can do for giving carers of all age ranges is absolutely essential.
OK, Robert's with us now. Hi, Robert. You're live with David Ashford, MHK.
How you doing? I've got a few questions.
Hi,
concerning
Robert.
Housing and the community board.
Okay.
How you doing,
yeah,
David?
Of course.
Okay. So, I'm disgruntled as a lot of people. So I'm not gonna. Fair play to you. You put your oar in, and I respect that. But what is the actual budget that the Housing Board have got from Treasury? And could you just give us an update on how that's going?
Yeah, so in terms of the Housing Communities Board, we don't have a budget as such. The point of the Housing Communities Board is we don't actually run the day-to-day housing. The day-to-day public housing function and the first-time buyer scheme actually and the housing division sit within the Department of Infrastructure. The purpose of the Housing Communities Board was to bring all the different agencies together, because housing sits in various different places, such as DHS, DOI, certain elements of policy and Cabinet Office, and bring all that together to try and get one fundamentally agreed approach across government. So the Housing Communities Board has a Housing Communities Fund. We roughly have around about $2 million in that fund. That's to help advance policy and to try and get different things off the ground. So one of the things we've been looking at as a board is in terms of mid-rent schemes, which we've been out for expressions of interest. progressed on. We've also been working with DOI to try and move forward a review of the first-time buyers policies, which is being done. We've also worked with DOI on looking at trying to move forward a build in public housing. DOI themselves have also, of course, created now the housing agency within DOI to try and move things forward. Because from my point of view as Chair of the Housing Communities Board, the most fundamental thing we need to do is actually build things. Because at the end of the day, we're not going to get anywhere unless we actually build houses. And one of the commitments that's come out of this administration, and it still amazes me that, you know, we are the first administration ever to actually make a pledge that over the next 10 years we will deliver 1,000 affordable houses. That has never been done before. There's never been a target set, but we've actually made that pledge now and we need to deliver on it.
Robert?
Yeah, okay, I respect that. I mean, it's a heck of an ask is 1,000 houses, but I mean, it's needed for the next generation. So, I mean, how do you expect to go about that, could I ask?
So there's several ways. So the first is the traditional way, from my point of view, which is engagement with the private sector. There is restrictions in planning, of course, that if you are building a development of so much size, there should be so many affordable housing units delivered. Via those sort of schemes, I think the pipeline's currently about 80 homes in the next sort of 12 to 18 months will be delivered via that route. But I've been quite firm on this as a politician. I think government itself needs to actually be able to look at land that it may have available and actually be able to provide that for affordable housing. Because the thing that always has frustrated me in politics is things get looked at in isolation. So public housing is looked at sort of over there, first time buyers over there, the rental market over in a different place. They're actually all interlinked, because if you're not building social housing, if you're not getting people into first-time buyers where they can own their own home, where are those people? They're stuck in the rental market, and what that does is it puts pressure on the rental market and drives up prices there. So the whole thing is interlinked, and you have to look at it as one big picture rather than just the different elements.
Robert?
Okay, that's good. I think you've done a good job there in answering the question.
All
thanks
right.
a lot.
Good to hear from you. Thanks for that. Just a quick a couple of diary notes, by the way. There's a meeting tonight at Baldrine, in Baldrine, to discuss the future of Baldrine Public Hall, the village's public hall. The Methodist Church is facing falling numbers, both local chapel and Sunday school, and the future is now being considered. Captain of the parish, Stephen Carter, will be chairing the requisition meeting tonight, Baldrine Methodist Hall, at 7:30. And Beach Buddies this coming Sunday morning is at Hango Hill in Castletown from 10:30. The clocks go forward, so don't be late.
Save 17% on the Loganair Tartan Sale with promo code SALE17. Book now at loganair.co.uk. TCs and exclusions apply, subject to availability.
Top of the Tops, brought to you by The French Air. At five is hospitality, a wide range of aprons, kitchen uniforms and front of house clothing unique to your business. New entry at number four is our eco-sustainable and organic ranges. At number three is workwear. Be safe, be seen and get your brand recognised. Sticking at number two, sportswear, names, numbers, sponsors, logos. We do it all. You pick the colours and we'll do the rest. And at number one is corporate wear, embroidered or printed, professional and stylish. Find us at theprintshedIOM.com, on Facebook or at Braddon Bridge Industrial Park.
Manx Solar Electrical offer wise solar and heating solutions for home and business. We're the Isle of Man's trusted experts in solar panels, Tesla battery storage and energy efficient heat pumps, helping you power your home sustainably and save money. Call 665800 or visit manxsolarelectrical.com.
Come to Manx Solar Electrical.
Our island's energy reimagined.
When you
miss the Kane and Wicker furniture range in store at Millichaps of Ramsey. Includes sofas, chairs, and swivel rocker chairs, dining sets, and coffee tables with designs featuring quality frames, beautiful fabrics, including Laura Ashley designs, and comfortable fully sprung seats with leather bindings. Plus, we have special offer suites and a huge range of window blinds to complement.
Discover exclusive Kane and Wicker furniture in store now at Millichaps of Ramsey.
Stock arriving weekly at Ramsey Garden Centre. Discover potted spring bulbs, summer bulbs, seed potatoes, onion and garlic sets, wildflower seeds, sweet pea, microgreens, plantable biodegradable pots and propagation essentials. Grow smarter, greener, season after season with Ramsey Garden Centre.
Are you a small charity here on the Isle of Man? Are you looking for volunteers, hoping to raise awareness and chasing those crucial pounds and pennies to support your work? Well, Manx Radio can help. You could be our next 1-3 Charity of the Week. With daily on-air coverage, podcast and social media promotion, we can help support you and those you help. Just email the numbers 123@manxradio.com and listen out for the feature each weekday between 1 and 3pm. The Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
David Ashford, MHK, is on. When's your next surgery at Willesden?
So it's always the third Saturday of every month. So the next one will be in April. And it's whatever the third Saturday is, Andy. I will just have a quick look at my calendar here. So it will actually fall on the 18th of April.
Okay.
Saturday the 18th of April at Willesden School.
What do you find out from those surgeries?
So it's always mixed. All constituents of Douglas North are welcome to come along. We get various issues. We've had, for instance, the group that are looking to save the field down on Ballinard Road there. They came to, not the last surgery, but the surgery before, to express their concerns about the potential for Douglas Council to put a compound on there. We have people who turn up with benefit issues. They have people who turn up with council issues because our local councillors are there too. We have, we are very lucky in Douglas North in that we have three active local councillors who come along to the surgeries as well, and it's a vast range of issues. It's everything you would expect an MHK to deal with, and probably a few extra bits as well.
Sheila dropped a note in just to say, when are Douglas Council going to build some new social housing?
So Douglas Council has just literally built some new social housing in addition to their existing stock. I was very honoured last week to be able to attend the opening of the James Brown flats up in my constituency of Willesden, which is 48 purpose-built flats that will make a huge difference in the community. We need more builds like that across the island, because we still have a lot of people who want to downsize, who have mobility problems, that are in properties that aren't really suitable for them. So it's great to see these sort of builds progressing, and it's by government working in partnership with the housing authorities that we actually get these things over the line, and it's great to have seen Douglas Council be able to deliver on that.
Okay, you must get people who come and see you talking about private rents, and this is where public sector housing can take up the slack, because obviously with a restriction, you know, supply and demand, if the supply is choked, then and the demand's high, then the prices are going to go up. What part does public housing play in that?
So I think it's two parts to it. So there's both public housing, and there's also the other part of people wanting to buy their own home. So it's affordable housing in the whole loop, and the affordable housing concept covers both. So public housing obviously plays a very big part, because there are people in our society, you know, who, you know, will never really realistically be able to afford their own home, and they're of a level of income where they need the help and support the public housing provides. There is also people who actually want to own their own home, but for various reasons either can't get the deposit together required for a mortgage, or need that little bit of help to be able to do so.
Well, they may be caught in that private rental
exactly
trap.
So we need to cater for both, because as I just said there a few minutes ago, if you've got a lack of public housing and you've got a lack of first-time buyers or the ability for people to buy their own homes, what you do is create the perfect storm, because where are those people going to be sat? They're going to be sat in rental accommodation, and what then it becomes is basically a bidding war where people will go out. There's very, you know, the supply of rental accommodation becomes restricted and prices go up, and that's why it's important that we support both ends of the housing scale.
How easy is it to get, I mean, what used to be called a government mortgage, to get help, public help, to purchase a house?
So there is the various different types of first-time buyer schemes. They're under review at the moment. I've always personally been very clear on this. I think there needs to be a range of options.
Right.
I believe there needs to be a mid-rent scheme. I believe there needs to be the ability for plot to build, which was very successful on the island in the 70s and 80s. Yeah. I believe there needs to be the traditional sort of first-time buyer schemes. We need a mix of things because everyone's situation is different. And I've also come to the conclusion, having been chair of the Housing Communities Board for the last 2.5 years, we need a specific scheme aimed at young people on our island. So people who are, you know, just coming into adulthood may have ambitions to have their own home and actually start families. We need a scheme, I personally believe, aimed directly at them to actually try and keep them on island.
Right.
The Tynwald Youth Select Committee did an absolutely excellent report looking into all of this, which was debated at the session of Tynwald we've just had. It was a brilliant report. I would say really urge people to go out and read it. These young people have done an excellent job and we need to act on the recommendations that came out of that.
What's the executive summary from you?
So the executive summary from me is we need more support for young people to stay on Ireland. There needs to be better ability for people to be able to actually buy their own homes, or where people have gone off to university, for them to come back and own their own home. I was one of those students that went off to university and then stayed and worked in the UK for a few years before I came back. And some young people never end up coming back because I've heard firsthand from families it's very hard for them to be able to get to that situation where they can buy their own home on Ireland. So the more I think about it, the more I've looked at it, I believe one of the key things for the next administration is bringing forward a scheme directly aimed at young people.
David, you're live with David Ashford. Hi, David.
Hi, Mr. Ashford. Hi, Andy.
Hi, David.
Can I just... the Minister to clarify two different issues, please, if I can. One is, you don't have a contract of employment, do you?
As an MHK, no, there's no contract of employment.
So that's fine. It's just that people keep coming on saying, including Andy slips it in now and again, sorry Andy, but you do slip it in saying they have a contract of employment. They do have what we call terms and conditions. But can I ask you, the second question would be, would you expect an elected member to, if they're looking after a constituency or whatever, to engage with the community and get involved within government departments? Because I'm worried at the minute we have probably about 6 or 7 politicians who are just throwing stones and big boulders into the political pond to see how far the ripples go. And I'll quote you a couple of people on that, and that's Hooper and Haywood.
Well, obviously, I'm not going to comment on individuals, but I mean, David, you know firsthand, as MHKs, people do the job very differently. You have some MHKs who very much want to get involved in the day-to-day of government. You have others that feel their strength is in scrutiny. There is no great job description. Once you're an elected member, how you do the job is up to you, and then ultimately your constituents will judge you at election time on whether they believe you've performed correctly or not. What I would say is, my point of view and the way I've always seen things is, I went into politics and I spent 8.5 years on Douglas Council before I even considered running for House of Keys, has always been community first. I've always wanted to, I came into politics to try and help people make their lives better and be able to support them when they feel they can't get support elsewhere. That's what I've tried to do. Maybe I haven't always been successful at it, but it's certainly the way I've always viewed the job. You know, an MHK has several roles. I wear several hats. I wear a hat as a government minister. I wear a hat, you know, as a parliamentarian, and I wear a hat as a constituency member. For me, the constituency has always been the first, Parliament second, and government third. That's the way I've always viewed it.
David?
Yeah. You still there, Andy?
Loud and clear.
Oh. All right, I thought you cut me off. Can I ask David too regarding this big hype now and again when politicians are saying things for the next election? How much would a forensic examination of the health service, never mind anything else, cost us?
Well, it depends how deep you went. As a former DHSC minister, I would say it wouldn't come cheap. I would say it'd run into several million pounds if you were going to do an absolutely proper forensic. Yeah, if you're going to do a proper forensic dive, because we've seen, you know, we've seen reports before into the health service, and it's always in the millions. It's never in the tens of thousands. It depends what you mean by a forensic audit, because there's different levels of that. There's different levels of that in accounting as well, in general accounting as well. So if you're looking at a high level audit where you look at the just the general headline figures, that could be done probably quite cheaply and quite easily. If you're talking about a deep dive into the absolute minutiae of every single thing that is spent across Manx Care, what it's providing, where it's going, that's a huge task.
Right. And how long would that take, do you think?
I wouldn't even want to put a time scale on it. You'd have to go out for tender. You'd have to see who's available with the expertise to do it. It could be something that could either be really simple, depending upon the scope, or something that could be absolutely complicated and cost a fortune. It all comes down at the end of the day to the scope of what you'd actually want.
David?
Thanks, Andy. Thanks, David.
All right. Cheers, mate. Appreciate it. Thank you. It's 21 minutes before one with David Ashford, MHK, on Man in Line today.
Adam Partridge here, auctioneers and valuers. I'm pleased to announce that we're returning to the island very soon and we'll be holding free valuation days on Monday the 30th of March from 9 till 12 at Castletown Civic Hall and on Wednesday the 1st of April from 12 till 3 at St Catherine's Church Hall in Port Erin. We can also do home visits by appointment or email us photos of your treasures via our website adampartridge.co.uk.
Charity of the Week, brought to you by Kell Properties.
St German's Cathedral Foundation for Music and the Arts' overarching mission is to promote, preserve and grow the musical and artistic life of the cathedral, support young musicians and enrich the cultural life of the Isle of Man through high quality choral and musical activity offered as a gift to our island community. For more information, visit cathedral.im.
This advert is brought to you by Kell Properties.
Heating oil for homes, powering farms and businesses, keeping you moving with petrol stations across the island. Ellen Vannin Fuels. Call us on 84 4000.
This April, experience Britpop up close with John Power. Cast the Lars and Me. Live at the Gaiety Theatre on Thursday the 9th of April. From the Lars to fronting cast, John brings the stories and the songs in an intimate evening of music, memories and laughter. It's for one night only, so don't miss John Power at the Gaiety Theatre, Thursday the 9th of April. Call the box office on 600-555 or book online at villagaiety.com.
Keen to end a run of three straight defeats, FC Isle of Man are back in action this weekend for their penultimate home game in the NWCFL Premier Division this season.
Touch towards goal here, bit of a scramble. Crook, who manages to swivel and put it into the top corner.
The Ravens return to the ball on Saturday to face a City of Liverpool side fighting for survival in their battle against relegation.
What a game. Is that the essence of what football is about?
Join me, Rob Pritchard and Darren Timpson for FC Isle of Man versus City of Liverpool, kicking off at 6 p.m. this Saturday. Manx Radio will be bringing you full live match commentary on our DAB and AM 1368 channels.
The Man in Line with Andy Wint.
Faster, my good afternoon. David Ashford, MHK, is on the air and got a message in from Rachel who said, Andy, you've not asked him yet. Well, I'll ask him then. Will you be standing in September's election for Douglas North?
Honest answer, I haven't decided or thought about it yet. I'll make my decision probably around about Easter time.
That's next week, by the way.
Yes, it is. It's about next week or week after. Yeah. I've got a young family at home again. I need to speak to them. I need to speak to my friends and family and then decide what I want to do. Time's ticking away. We're on the countdown to the election now. So I need to make a decision pretty sharpish one way or the other. But what I can guarantee people is once I've made that decision, Manx Radio and the listener and my constituents will be the first people to know.
Thank you. Texter 429, my question for Mr. Ashford may not directly fall under Housing and Communities Board, but it's this. What can be done to stop private sector rents going through the roof, especially when you have certain landlords charging the best part of £1,000 for a one-bed flat?
I think what's important is twofold. So we've already spoken today on the programme about the need to actually provide different types of housing, which will help relieve the pressure in the private sector. That's one of the pieces. The second piece is actually around looking at the condition of flats and also properties, and ensuring that there's appropriate regulation and enforcement in place. Obviously, there is legislation pending in relation to that that's been pending for several years that the next administration will have to make a very quick decision on. So I think it's multifaceted, the things that you would actually need to do, because rent controls, to be frank, which is some of the things we hear about, they don't tend to work. They tend to be very, very blunt instruments. And if you get them wrong, you actually create a bigger problem, because what you end up doing is penalising the small landlords who actually then decide it's not actually worth their while actually renting property. They sell up and you end up with actually less rental properties, not actually more. And one of the issues we do have on Ireland is, despite sometimes the myth that goes around that there's these huge landlords with multiple properties all over the place, and there is a few, the vast majority of our landlords are people who have one, maybe two houses they've inherited that they've then put out to rent, and are small landlords, many of them with actually buy-to-let mortgages that they've seen go through the roof over the last 4 years. So their costs have actually gone up as well. So I've never been a great supporter of rent controls, because I think the unintended consequences, looking at other countries that have gone on the rent control issue, can actually be just as damaging to the market and to actually renters as the problem it's trying to solve.
Okay. Regarding the carer's allowance, this text of 299 said, applications for benefits like carer's allowance, DLA and what have you, take months to process. Could that issue be resolved? And allied to that, text of 768 said, I don't think any child should be seen as a carer. They need their childhood and didn't ask to be put into the situation. Most are very selfless. There should be enough free care available to take the burden off them.
And I actually agree that one of the pieces we need to look at is, as I said earlier in the programme, help and support, particularly for those young carers, because every child does deserve a childhood. Every child deserves an education, and they deserve to be able to have their own hopes and dreams realised. And so it's important that we do put support around those young carers in particular. It's something I've always been passionate about in politics, and it's something, if I do decide to stay in politics and stand again and was re-elected, I'd continue to be passionate about. In terms of benefits, there's a move going on to digitise more, which will help speed things up. There also, of course, is options now in terms of AI. You still need that human interaction and that human check at the end, because AI is not the infallible thing we sometimes make it out to be. But there is various AI tools that can now be put in place with processing as well to help speed things up. So there are things going on in the background around government processes, not just in relation to benefits, but government processes in general, that should make things more efficient and more effective for people.
Okay, text to 382. Please pardon his blushes. Thank David for his COVID management. Wonderful communication and commitment to us. The Manx, seems a parallel universe, doesn't it, COVID?
Do you know, it just seems a lifetime away,
doesn't it? Six years ago.
I mean, it's hard to believe. It was a bit of a whirlwind, to be honest.
Okay, they go on. But ask David, why Manx utilities are renting high-level space down at the old Douglas amenities and the extremely large building on the corner of the same space. The rent was listed as £65,000 and £70,000, totaling £135,000 a year. This could be out of town in a cheaper location. Please look into their spending. It all comes back to local people.
I'll be honest, I don't know the answer to that. I'm off the top of my head, I wasn't aware they were doing that. What I will undertake to do, as I do whenever I appear on this programme, Andy, is I'll go away, see if I can find an answer. I'll share it with you so you can share it with the listeners.
Okay, and a message in also from Dahlia. Hello, Dahlia. Just said, will the Manx Development Corporation play any part in loosening the bonds in the housing market?
I think the Manx Development Corporation does have a part to play. I personally think we need to look at the scope and what we do with the Manx Development Corporation. There is a lot of the primary focus for the Manx Development Corporation has been brownfield sites, but through no fault, I must say, of the Manx Development Corporation, a lot of those sites, certainly in my opinion, haven't come online quick enough. You look around Douglas, you've still got the Park Road site that's vacant. I went to a presentation when I was Mayor of Douglas, and I had hair in those days, Andy, that said we were going to have a wonderful development on that site. It yet hasn't happened.
Yeah.
You know, there's the prison site up on Victoria Road. We need to look at all these sites, and we need to find a much better way across government of having one estate management. That work is underway now of ensuring that all the estates are pulled together right. in one place so we can properly strategically plan across the sites government has.
So is it fair to say that Manx Development Corporation would like more land, but the various departments can't decide who's going to give some land?
I think they have been stunted to a certain extent due to restraints and debates over what land should be used for. But I think there is much more we can make with Manx Development Corporation. But equally, alongside that, we need to work with the existing private sector development businesses as well on the island, working in partnership with them to provide what our island needs.
OK, and Andrew's with us now. Hi, Andrew. You're live with David Ashford, MHK.
Hi there. Good day to you. Apologies, I've only just managed to listen in, so I don't know what's gone before. But please, David, a politician, the purpose of a politician, to represent the people and then to provide policy and direction. And so I'm wondering, in respect of the Cabinet Office, what is the requirement for a minister other than to pad out, in inverted commas, comb in and support the Chief Minister?
So Cabinet Office, in terms of the ministerial role, it crosses a broad range of things. So we have planning policy that sits within Cabinet Office. We have Crown and External Relations, although that generally is dealt with by the Chief Minister himself. We actually have the Government Technology Function within there. We have the Office of Human Resources as well. We have the Central Policy Function, one of my other functions, not because I'm Cabinet Office Minister, but one I brought with me is, of course, Chair of the Housing Communities Board. So it is quite a wide-ranging remit. We have the International Development Fund that sits within there as well. So it is a wide-ranging remit that comes under the Minister for the Cabinet Office. It's not purely a support.
Please,
function.
If I may interject, why is a minister needed when it's got a Chief Executive Officer and a Chief Operating Officer and a whole raft of subordinates doing administrative work?
So in law, departments require a minister. In the past, there's always been a minister for the Cabinet Office. The difference with this administration is the minister for the Cabinet Office in previous administrations used to be the Chief Minister themselves. The current Chief Minister, when he became Chief Minister, made the decision to divide the two off. And so effectively, what was the Minister for Policy and Reform that sat within the Cabinet Office became a much wider Cabinet Office minister, taking on some of the responsibilities that previously would have been signed off by the Chief Minister.
So it's again creating an additional post within Comin.
It didn't create an additional post. I just need to be clear on that. It replaced the Minister for Policy and Reform post. So it was merged in, that sat within Cabinet Office, it was merged in with that. So there was no additional role created in Council of Ministers. The numbers in Council of Ministers didn't change at that point.
Okay. All right. Andrew, thanks for calling today. In fact, Gaz dropped that note in to say also, the Cabinet Office at the core has grown significantly in the past 10 years. Why is that?
So, because the functions that have transferred into Cabinet Office have grown significantly in the last 10 years. So I mentioned a couple there around planning policy, the central planning policy function, the Office of Human Resources. All that has actually, if you go back over 10 years, merged into Cabinet Office. So a lot of the growth in Cabinet Office has actually been functions coming away from other departments and other areas into the centre and bringing with them, obviously, the people employed in those areas. Cabinet Office also runs on behalf of government several projects at various times. So if you go into the headcount report that's now published as well, we have people on long-term contracts. So they're not permanent members of staff. We actually employ FTE for very specific projects as well that then go down. So COVID, we mentioned earlier, Andy, a lot of the COVID functions sat within Cabinet Office. So, for instance, the Trace team, they were, and MCAL's team, as was set up originally, the telephone team, they sat in Cabinet Office. But then once COVID was over, they dissipated. So the headcount within Cabinet Office has been flexible over the 10 years, depending upon what functions has been in the department.
OK, Howard, you're live with David Ashford, MHK.
Oh, yeah, Andy. Hello, David.
Hi, Howard.
Just a curio, and something I haven't seen up lately again. What was that one with the done the housing, the Fletcher said to the old nurses' home, the Housing Development Corporation?
Manx Development Corporation.
Manx Development Corporation, yeah.
Ah, that's all right. I just couldn't remember what the letter was. But now that the Lord Street car park development has been given planning permission, and several people have said, oh, it should be a car park, etc. But refresh me, down where the lifting bridge, what they term as the long-term car park, and then I've used it for the steam packet, the Housing Development Corporation had artist impressions and photographs of what they were going to build was a multi-story car park down there, and it looked more like a hotel, a very expensive-looking building. Have you heard any more about that?
So this will be, from my memory, if we're talking about the same site, which I hope we are, we're talking about the Parade Street site, which sits behind the current steam packet headquarters.
By Circus Beach, yeah.
Yeah, so there was plans, I believe, to develop that site. I'll be honest, I don't know where they're up to at the moment or whether they're actually proceeding, but you're quite right, there were actually plans in place for a development down there. I don't know how far that's got, and it certainly, from what I've seen, hasn't come anywhere near planning yet.
Mm-hmm. Because it looks a very expensive building over the top for a car park, and now we got national car parks that's biting the dust in the UK. If they have something like that here, it probably wouldn't be utilized to its best ability because of the cost, the charges.
And maybe that's why it hasn't proceeded anywhere, because maybe they've done a cost analysis and it hasn't stacked up. I must be honest, yeah. I'm not cited on that, the development of that site. I do remember there was plans for the Parade Street site. I mean, the important thing for me as a Douglas MHK is we do get that area down in Lower Douglas developed. It's sat empty.
Definitely.
For far, far too long. The old bus station site, the Cambrian Place site across the road, mm-hmm. the Parade Street site. You know, that's one of the first impressions people get coming off,
yes,
out
all
of the sea terminal,
the railway station.
Into our capital city. So yeah. It is important that we get the development, and I hope that, you know, whatever the final thing that comes out in the Lord Street site, and I know it's been publicly controversial, but anything that kickstarts development down there, from my point of view as a Douglas MHK, has got to be a good thing.
I don't disagree with that, David. It
all
needs
right. All right, good to hear from you. Thanks,
okay.
Howard.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, Howard.
Just a couple of quick questions. The horse trams back to the sea terminal, yes or no?
Oh, yes, I've supported the whole way along.
Provided they're not standing in Douglas North, what's your advice to a prospective MHK?
Just do your best, engage with people, and try and be true to yourself.
So after Easter, we'll know whether you're standing.
After Easter, I'll make the decision around Easter.
All right, thanks for being with us today. Good to talk to you.
Thanks, Andy.
You've been with David Ashford, MHK, and if you didn't catch all of it, that's fine. You can catch it as a podcast any time of day or night. Go to manxradio.com or wherever you listen to your podcast and hear the whole thing again. Back on Monday, another open line on Manx Radio. In the meantime, enjoy your weekend. Watch out for the weather.
WIL